Hey, thanks for listening. One quick note before you start. There is an audio issue with this episode. There's a high-pitched squeal that happens every now and again. So just so you know, it's not you, it's me. Enjoy the episode. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Dissident Orthodoxy. I'm Casey Hobbs. Today is going to be a conversation with myself and Dean Strang. He practices law in Madison, Wisconsin. He's the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in the Time of Terror. He is a person that you might recognize from a Netflix series called Making a Murderer. He defended an innocent man there. And we are going to talk about his book, Keep the Wretches in Order, America's Biggest Mass Trial, The Rise of the Justice Department and the Fall of the IWW. So, Dean, thank you so much for joining me today.
Casey, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Okay, so kind of give us a broad overview of this work and how you got interested in the Wobblies in particular and in this really remarkable, wild instance of the trial.
I had bumped into the history of the labor movement at a very superficial level as an undergrad. You know, wrote my longest paper as an undergrad on the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. Knew, you know, just knew something superficially about the origins of unionism in the United States. And then really this book came out of a discovery I made in researching my first book, which you were kind enough to mention. The first book concerned a trial of 11 suspected anarchists, all of whom were Italian immigrants in Milwaukee, just shortly after we got into World War I. Mm. And as I say, in researching that, I tripped across the outlines of this story, which immediately hooked me at a couple of levels. None of them terribly intellectually structured or three-dimensional. But one, because I've been a criminal defense lawyer now for 34 years, running into something that looked like the biggest mass trial ever conducted in U.S. civilian courts, you know, just immediately looked interesting to me. Second, I'm a lifelong lover of baseball. and the trial judge for this largest of all mass trials just happened to be the federal district judge in Chicago, who a few years later would go on to become the first commissioner of Major League Baseball, Kennesaw mm-hmm. Mountain Landis. Now, Landis is no hero, either as a baseball commissioner no. or as a federal judge, but nonetheless, the coincidence of an enormous federal criminal trial, the biggest criminal trial ever in United States history, and the relationship to baseball had me hooked. And in general,
I want to cut you off there because I was that was something I wanted to ask you about, mainly because when I started Public Theologians podcast, which this is sort of a spiritual successor to and actual successor to, I guess. I did that with a friend of mine named Jaran Hill, and he is from Chicago, a big White Sox fan. And so when I came across the Landis reference there and the large part he plays, obviously, as a judge in this trial, I wanted to ask you about that too, mainly just to kind of rib him and sending this episode down the line to, you know, kind of highlight the Black Sox and and all of these things. Right. So anyways, yeah.
Yeah, it, so this also then just happened to fit in with my principal scholarly interest, if you will, which is looking at how the U.S. criminal enforcement machinery operates under significant stressors. I like to look at that historically because I think it's easier than for people to draw their own connections to our lives, our times. and make such distinctions or see such similarities and dissimilarities as they will. But it's easier for people to look at something in a historical context, I think. And also the late progressive era, and you know, the time when the United States joins World War I, mm-hmm. is really a great laboratory, if you will, for looking at stresses on the criminal enforcement machinery. Mm. The First Amendment is not what we know it today. The words have never changed, you know, since 1791, but the Supreme Court's understanding of it was nowhere near as robust as it became in the late 30s and 40s and continuing till today. For two, we were at war, you know, we were mobilizing a massive, unprecedented war effort in an unprecedented war that was not a purely regional conflict. We're also, by the time April of 1917 comes and the US joins the European War, we are also nearing the tail end of about three decades of unprecedented immigration to the United States, including Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, and you know, not purely sort of Anglophile and Scandinavian areas of Europe. And there's a good deal of friction at that time, and nativist resentment of newcomers. And you're also seeing the labor movement really beginning to gel and rise during this time. So all of those factors together, it's a bit of a witch's brew, obviously, but they, all of them result in significant challenges then that courts and the whole criminal process faces in how it's going to try to administer punishment or, you know, make some claim of justice as to people charged with crimes.
And that's a really important context. And I think even looking back at that time, it's hard to really understand, at least for me, speaking personally, the pressures of World War One, or the Great War, I guess it was called then. And the reaction, like you said, from the left, from the organized labor unions, that really saw this as a rich man's war, as a war that had really nothing to do with the working class, which not the first or the last war you could say that about. But in particular, to the Wobblies here, that go on this massive trial, what was it about what they were saying and doing that was such a threat to become this this wild story?
Well, the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, nicknamed the Wobblies, derisively initially, but they welcomed the nickname. Mm-hmm. They adopted the nickname. So I'll, you know, generally refer to them as the IWW, but the formal name was the Industrial Workers of the World, founded in 1905 in Chicago, kind of an outgrowth of the Western Federation of Miners, which had been around for something like a quarter century at that point. Was a radical union in several senses of that word, in more than one sense of that word, okay? It was radical in the sense of changing or challenging and shaking up the then existing union movement, labor movement, by framing its reason for being as the failures of the model of trade unionism, of organizing workers by trade or by craft. And from perspective of the folks who founded the Industrial Workers of the World and wrote its constitution and preamble, really what my words here, but what the trade union approach or framework did was pit worker against worker for the same dime from the employer, serve the interest of capital or employers by pitting stonemasons against carpenters, for example, or, you know, plumbers against electricians, whatever it might be. And so what was really innovative and radical about the model that the IWW proposed and adopted is we're going to look past what your job title is or what your skill is, what your art, you know, your craft is. And we're going to look at the broad industry in which you're employed. And so if you're in shipping, you should be allied with every other worker who's involved in the shipping industry in any way. If you're in farming, if you're in mining, and so forth, that really labor workers ought to be organized by broad industry so that they present a united front across their various skills and trades against capital, against employers. And then those industrial unions themselves ought to be united under one umbrella, one big union, which is the original nickname of the IWW and the one they set out as their goal. We were going to be one big union, uniting all workers in an effort to create something that was sort of fuzzily described as industrial democracy.
Yeah, no, I love that. And that's that universality, I think, is what really draws me even to the topic of the Wobblies or the IWW. And I mean, I think particular to this moment, you know, we've got Christian Smalls in New York with the Amazon Labor Union. You've got Starbucks places trying, or you know, stores trying to unionize, McDonald's as we're recording this in May, workers were walking off the job in multiple places. I think it was the day before yesterday I saw. There's this moment right now of a move towards another kind of universality. And I think it's interesting when you talk about like the threat that becomes, you know, if that really becomes a, you know, more than just an isolated movement, but just becomes one union. And I think, yeah, that's the brilliance of and the obvious danger that they would, the IWW would have presented.
That's right. And look, I don't know that ideologically, you know, what we're seeing with Amazon and Starbucks and McDonald's and all that, I don't know that ideologically there's a great deal of similarity to, you know, the IWW thinking of 100 or 120 years ago. But what really is similar in the nascent efforts you've just described and reawakening of the labor movement right now is challenging the old orthodoxies about how to organize workers and how to structure unions and how to pursue equity in the workplace. And that the IWW very much did. So, you know, for example, the IWW rejected the idea of labor contracts, of collective bargaining agreements, wouldn't sign them, saw them as traps. When the AFL, the sort of unions under Samuel Gompers' overall leadership, very much was looking for industrial peace by negotiating, using the collective power of labor to negotiate a bargaining agreement. IWW wanted nothing to do with that. Their basic approach was, if things go okay on Monday, when we show up to work, we'll come back on Tuesday.
Sure.
and if it's not so bad on Tuesday, we'll consider showing up on Wednesday. And the minute we don't like what's happening here, we're going to strike.
Yeah.
And that may be a so-called wildcat strike. And because we're organized by industry, we have the potential to call a general strike affecting all employers in a particular sector of the economy. So that sort of innovation and challenging the conventional ideas of other labor leaders at the time, is that's where I today really see an echo of in these new and emergent efforts to organize some of the biggest companies of our day.
Yeah, yeah, that's I love that, and I guess the maybe that sets it up as a as maybe an eerie conversation moving forward, because obviously the threat was there and the mass of the government kind of, well, not kind of, the mass of the government gets all together in this narrative. So kind of talk about Frank Little and how his advocacy and his death set off this whole dominoes of the US government versus the IWW.
Frank Little was the ideal poster child, if you will, or emblem for the United States Justice Department to paste on the IWW. The real concern, I'll explain that, the real concern of the Justice Department here and the Woodrow Wilson administration generally is that the IWW was radical in another sense. Many of its members were really at the far left edge of the left in America at the time. And as you say, we're challenging the legitimacy of the war, saying, why is this a working man's problem? You know, to which collapsing monarchy in Europe prevails, why is that our issue?
Yeah.
You know, any working person's issue. And the IWW, which the government would have noticed, did notice, saw its ranks swell shortly after 1914 when war breaks out in Europe. You know, it starts, its membership starts growing rapidly in the United States, also in England and Canada. And the United States government, the federal government, although initially it's Western business interests and Western state governments that are first sounding the alarm bell, but the realization comes, wait a minute here. We're trying to mobilize very rapidly to get a million soldiers across the Atlantic to Europe to join this war, you know, in the spring of 1917. And here we've got a union that is vocally, many of the members and leadership vocally opposing the effort to join the European war. And where are they strong? In what industries are they strong? Well, they've got a lot of members up in the Northwest in lumber and logging. And we need lumber and logging for ships and for these newfangled things called airplanes, which, you know, had wooden frames at the time. And, oh, where else are they strong? Well, they're strong in copper mining, lead mining, you know, from the West down to the Southwest, the whole mining ranges of the West and Southwest. You need copper and lead to make munitions. Where else are they strong? Well, they're strong in the Mesabi Range in northern Minnesota with iron. You need iron for guns and cannons and all this stuff. Well, where else are they strong? Well, they're strong in the Midwest, in the breadbasket, in agriculture. They have great strength in South Dakota and south into Kansas and, you know, Iowa and Missouri. And that's where we grow wheat. And the food we will need to send to soldiers and soldiers overseas. Well, where else are they strong? Well, they're strong down in the textile mills of the Southeast. And they're strong in agriculture and environment, cotton. We need that for uniforms. You know? And finally, where else are they strong? Well, they're really strong. I mean, one of their real strongholds was on the docks on the Eastern Seaboard, Philadelphia, you know, up and down the Atlantic coast. And that's where we're shipping the munitions, we're shipping the soldiers, we're shipping everything else, you know, that we need to maintain supply lines and to support European allies. And so the state governments and large industries and eventually the federal government figure out if the IWW calls a general strike or continues to grow mm-hmm. as it was growing rapidly, this could really hamper the national war effort. And that put a target on the IWW. Frank Little, to come back to your question, was one of five members of the General Executive Board of the IWW. He was probably its most effective organizer, speaker on the stump. He could draw thousands of workers. And he was politically the most outspoken about the war being wrong, that America should not join the war. He was outspokenly anti-war. Not all of the members of the General Executive Board were. Some of them were more circumspect, at least in their public comments. And I think on the whole, the IWW really left the issue of conscription or volunteering or supporting the war or not to the individual consciences of its, by 1917, nearly 100,000 members. But Frank Little was unabashed in his public opposition to the war, and it made him just a very good emblem for the government to paste on the IWW, because in general, you saw a surge of patriotism, as you generally do when we go to war, and mainstream America, if you will, was largely supportive of the effort and accepted the government's line that this is a war we need to fight.
Sure. Yeah. So then he is, he's murdered, and this kind of, like I said, sets off this massive investigation, if you can call that, seizure of documents, is kind of more, seems like what happened. And then this trial that, I don't have the number in front of, was it 146 that were originally indicted?
And 166 originally indicted. So you're right. Frank Little gets murdered, probably by off-duty police officers working under the hire of mining companies out in Butte, Montana. And he gets murdered on August 1st, 1917, which is right about the time that the federal Justice Department has decided on a strategy. We're going to indict and try to decapitate the IWW. We're going to resist the temptation to try them in military tribunals or lock them up without charges, or, you know, there were some really sort of extreme ideas floated around, including in the Wilson administration. They settle on a more legalist approach, which is to say something that will be clad in the garb of law and look superficially lawful. And they're just gearing up to do that at the time Frank Little gets murdered. He would have been the most prominent defendant, or one of the most prominent defendants in the indictment. So from a trial lawyer standpoint, it becomes kind of a tricky problem for the prosecutors, because, you know, they really want him to be the mascot of the IWW, and now he's dead. He can't be tried. So they named him as an unindicted co-conspirator and introduced a lot of his statements and whatnot during the trial. But you're right that when the indictment comes in late September 1917, there's 166 people indicted in one case. And then there are three other cases. That flagship case, the first one, was in federal court in Chicago, 166 defendants. Three other indictments that are smaller, but still vast, you know, 30 plus groups of defendants follow in three other cities across the country later. But the Chicago trial is the first to go. It's the largest group. It's got all the leaders of the IWW, and it's the one that's the main focus of my book.
Yeah. And in that, and as far as the leadership, I thought it was really interesting to read about the differences that Big Bill Haywood and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who is, if I'm remembering this right, the only woman that was indicted in this, the difference they had in their trial strategies, and particularly as a defense lawyer, I'm curious to hear more of your take on the strategic move of Haywood and most of the, virtually all of the defendants, to stay kind of in a solidarity mindset and be tried all together, where Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and others took a different route.
Yeah, it's a very perceptive point. I mean, first of all, your facts are right. In the 166 defendants, there's exactly one woman, and it's Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. Now, Mary Jones, more popularly known as Mother Jones, had been involved in the founding of the IWW back in 1905, but she was not indicted here. Gurley Flynn was the only woman indicted. And Bill Haywood, who you mentioned, often called Big Bill Haywood, who was the general secretary, so the titular head, if you will, to the extent there was one of the IWW, becomes really the lead defendant. His name is first in the indictment, and he's most associated among the living people, you know, aside from Frank Little. And you are, again, correct that Haywood and many of the other leaders and organizers of the IWW advocated a one-for-all, all-for-one approach. And they wound up hiring one lawyer for the entire group. Now, that at the time was not unusual. You know, this is before 1963, when the US Supreme Court finally says, look, if you're indigent, the government has to pay for a lawyer to defend you. So, you know, back in 1917, government doesn't have to give you a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And most people charged with crimes then and now are too poor to hire a lawyer. So what you did back in those days was pool your money and try to get at least one lawyer to represent often 5, 10, 20, or in this case, more than 160 people. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and a couple of her East Coast friends were able to hire their own lawyer. You know, one representing just three defendants. And he took a legalist approach. You know, he took a lawyerly approach, moved to sever his clients for a later trial, and had arguments on why severance was required for a fair trial. And the government took note of that. I think it's impossible actually at this remove to know exactly why the government was worried about that severance motion. Now, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was among the best known figures in the labor movement at the time, very effective speaker and organizer. And the government, with her two friends who were represented by the same lawyer, the government had failed to convict them. The state government of Massachusetts had failed to convict them in an earlier trial arising out of a strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. But I can only speculate. But in the end, what happens is the Justice Department agrees to the severance motion that Gurley Flynn and the other two have brought, which functionally means the case is over for them. You know, the government isn't going to go back and retry a case of this size against just three people later. And that at least would have been a pretty good bet by the lawyer. Mm-hmm. And that's, in fact, how it played out. So she was spared the trial, along with Joseph Attor and Carlo Tresca, by succeeding in that severance effort, which again, the government did not oppose in the end.
Okay, so I want to hit on a couple of figures real quick from the other side, from the prosecution side, and then kind of unfold the drama a little bit and kind of hit on some interesting questions, especially about what this meant for the rise of the Justice Department, as part of your subtitle indicates. So there is an Alabamian that I thought we should talk about because I'm in Alabama. He's from Tuscaloosa, and he's William C. Fitz, and he's actually the one that had the quote, "Keep the wretches in order." And obviously he plays a very prominent role in this narrative. And so again, as someone living in Alabama, I thought I would ask you particularly about him.
Sure, sure. So William Fitz is at this time, in the summer of 1917, he's an assistant attorney general of the United States. He's been in Washington since 1914, as a special assistant to the attorney general. And in 1917, he becomes an assistant attorney general. His little footnote in history, really more than this case, is that he and a general named Enoch Crowder wrote the Conscription Act of 1917, mm-hmm. wrote the statute that created a nationwide draft for purposes of World War I. But he's also in the small brain trust at the Justice Department who are developing this legal strategy against the IWW. And you are right that the title of the book is his, in a sense, he wrote it. In July of 1917, he writes a letter, one of many he wrote, trying to placate a U.S. senator from out west that, yes, the Justice Department's going to do something about the IWW. He writes a letter, as I say, trying to placate a U.S. senator, saying, "Fear is the only thing that will keep the wretches in order." I thought that just captured the authoritarian impulse of a prosecutor better than I possibly could. So I stole it, or the second half of that phrase as the title of the book. But Fitz himself is essentially a politico. Mm-hmm. You know, and he graduates from law school, or not, you know, graduates with a bachelor in laws at age 20, mm-hmm. And goes to work for a small firm in Tuscaloosa. And within 8 years, I think by the time he's 28, he's elected the attorney general of Alabama.
Wow.
Yeah. And he also then is elected a delegate to the 1901 Constitutional Convention for Alabama, which you may know about, which is that's an explicitly white supremacist effort to, you know, entrench Jim Crow and white supremacy into the Constitution of Alabama. A number of Southern states did that in the 1890s and early 1900s. And later, you know, after this stint at the Justice Department in World War I, he just kind of hangs around DC for a while and gets patronage jobs, and then eventually becomes general counsel of the company that was the biggest competitor of Western Union in delivering telegraphs. He goes up to New York City and gets this fancy corporate job as general counsel, does that for 10 years. And then goes back to Alabama, to Birmingham now, to the biggest city, and founds a law firm and becomes the state chair of FDR's initial campaign for president in 1932. So he's just around Democratic politics, as I say, sort of living on patronage jobs and then moving into nicely paid gigs in the private sector for most of his life.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting too, because I mean, the revolving door, whether it's between being a lobbyist and being in elected office, or whether it's again being having board seats on Raytheon or something, and then helping, you know, being also in an administration, or even like, you know, updated to now being on MSNBC, and nobody says, oh yeah, by the way, this guy is this talking about how great all of these weapons are that we need to make sure that everyone has. He's also, you know, on the board of Raytheon. That's kind of important. Yeah, it was fun in a way, I guess, to see like, oh, well, that's not new. So just an entrenched problem, I suppose. But yeah, he was kind of a forerunner to a lot of kind of slimy people that are out there now, which is...
Yeah, I'm sure there were those before him and many after him. Yeah, but he's a modestly interesting figure in that sense, and an utterly uninteresting one at another level.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so someone that's, I don't think anyone's ever described as uninteresting. You and I talked about him already, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis. So obviously, as the title would indicate, he is the judge for this. So talk about how he became judge and then kind of getting into the trial, what impact he had on this historical massive trial.
Well, Landis is another guy whose ambition maybe outstrips his talent. There are many of us like that.
Right, right.
That's probably me too, right? Yeah. But he's the son of a Civil War veteran, a surgeon who had served in the Civil War, and that sort of looms very large over Kennesaw Mountain Landis, starting with his name. He's named right. Kennesaw Mountain because that's the battle in Georgia at which his father was shot in the leg and nearly lost his life through infection, but survived, made it home, back to Ohio, sires Kennesaw Mountain Landis and other children, and eventually end up in Indiana. And what Landis is good at all his life is attaching himself to more powerful people, ingratiating himself with people who can mentor him or bring him along. You know, he becomes a court reporter, literally the stenographer in court, because he's close with a county politician in Indiana. And he eventually begins to practice law and moves to Chicago and attaches himself to initially, I think, the Grover Cleveland administration, but quite flexibly when Cleveland, who's a Democrat, is not in office anymore, then Landis sort of morphs into a Republican and he attaches himself to Republican office holders mm-hmm. who can advance his career.
Which again sounds a bit familiar, but
yeah, I mean he's just flexible, and his ambitions, I think, more than principles guide him.
Sure.
And he does ingratiate himself with these more powerful men who advance him and open doors for him. And by the way, it must have been something of a family trait, because he had a brother who became the postmaster of the Philippines, when we owned the Philippines or occupied the Philippines through patronage. And Landis finagles a federal judgeship in Chicago through this sort of patronage. Never much of a practicing lawyer. Not the first federal judge you could describe that way either, mm-hmm. But he's not a politico in the sense of somebody who's ever run for office himself.
Sure.
He just sort of attaches himself to politically powerful people and then, sees where that carries him, and which is usually upward
Sure. For
Landis. And so he becomes a federal judge, late 1890s, I think. I may be off on that. And you know, he winds up sort of stereotypically looking the part. He's got this thick head of white hair and he's got a craggy face. You know, he kind of looks like, you know, even in a day when white men occupied all positions of prominence and power, he looks like the prototype, you know.
Right. A man among men.
Yeah, the man among men. He's you know, he's ramrod straight and thin and sinewy and has a booming voice. Mm-hmm. He's actually picked by the federal government to play the role of a federal judge in a movie the government made, an educational movie the government made about federal judges.
Okay? Wow.
The federal judiciary, an early, you know, some little early short movie.
Yeah.
So he's literally sort of out of central casting.
Sure.
And what he's known for before the IWW trial really are two things. One, fashioning himself a progressive of the era, a trust buster, mm-hmm. You know, somebody who does not like large conglomerations of capital controlling markets. And so he imposes what was then the largest fine ever on Standard Oil, an antitrust civil trial, or maybe it was criminal trial, I'm sorry, which that fine gets knocked down somewhat on appeal. But he becomes famous for that, one. And for two, he's a patriot. He's a patriot's patriot. He said that his father's Civil War experience loomed over his life. It really did. All his life, Landis is a favorite of the American Legion. He's a pro-military, if not pro-war, and, you know, my government, right or wrong, kind of guy, especially during wartime. That's a thread that runs through the entirety of his life.
Sure.
So he eventually then probably, I can't prove this, probably engineers the assignment of this case to him. Although that's, I can't prove that.
So as the judge then presiding over the trial, and so there was 166 indictments, and a bit of those weren't apprehended, because as you mentioned, you know, in the early 1900s, it was probably a lot easier to evade the law if you just kind of went over the border, if you changed your name. There's, you know, fingerprinting and all that is not a thing. So
it's becoming a thing, but no, you're right. And so 166 people indicted, the fall off. By the time you start trial, you've got 112 people who've been apprehended. And then, you know, and there were three who were severed, but you've got 112 people in the courtroom. Other than the three who were severed, they just never were able to arrest most of the others. Some they did, and they were too sick to stand trial or died before trial. But you're on the first day of jury selection, you've got 112 defendants in one courtroom at one time on trial for one case.
Yeah, so how did, and I want people to read the book, so I won't give too much away. I don't want you to give too much away either. But just to kind of connect this to the rise in the Justice Department and how this really leads to a gigantic, you can speak much more to this than I can, but you know, gigantic bureaucracy that has a lot of sway in the lives of, as you mentioned, particularly poor people, and then, you know, these sort of enemies of the state. I was thinking, reading this particular to the Espionage Act, I was thinking of recently Julian Assange. Back in the 70s or 70s with Daniel Ellsberg, and the various ways that people exposing government crimes or that are just don't have the means to really defend themselves. So yeah, talk about how, as this played out, the Justice Department grew in that moment.
Well, let's start a little earlier, because this is not, I think, not as widely known as one might think. There's always been an Attorney General of the United States since you know, our Constitution was adopted and you know, the first presidential election held and cabinet assembled. Always has been an Attorney General of the United States since the late 1780s. So you might have assumed, and many people would assume, there was always a Justice Department, because sure, we know today that the Attorney General is the cabinet level official who is the head of the Justice Department. Well, until 1870, so, you know, for more than 80 years of the life of the United States of America, the Attorney General had no department. The Attorney General was just a legal advisor to the President of the United States. Was a member of the cabinet, but had literally no department.
Interesting.
You know, into the 1810s, 20s, 30s, he's got like two part-time office boys, you know, total appropriation other than for a salary for the Attorney General of the United States. In 1870, Congress creates the Justice Department. So, you're 5 years after the end of the Civil War, the assassination of the President of the United States, for which there was no federal response other than military. And you're into Reconstruction and, you know, needing to knit the breakaway Confederate states back into the Union and also try to, you know, sort of enforce, give some meaning to the post Civil War amendments. And so Congress decides to create a national law enforcement agency, if you will, in the Justice Department, and puts the Attorney General in charge of that. But that's, you know, that's still not a very big organization. And at the time, the federal prosecutors in all of the federal districts around the country, 93 of them today, really were not directed by the Attorney General. They were independent presidential appointees. And so they had their own little fiefdoms, and there weren't many federal criminal statutes to enforce. Some counterfeiting laws, some anti-fraud laws that get passed in the aftermath again of the Civil War with Reconstruction, with, you know, people ripping off the South, the people in the South, with fraudulent schemes. But you have this Justice Department, which sort of remains in its cradle, Casey, until this case. You know, I mean, there was some effort of the Justice Department to address the original iteration of the Ku Klux Klan. But even that was sporadic in the 1870s. And this case, I make the argument, at least in the book, that this case is where the Justice Department comes into its own. It has this little Bureau of Investigation inside the Justice Department, which is only 8 years old itself in 1917. And here it's trying to mount a prosecution against people who are spread all over the country, with union offices all over the country, and address what is perceived as a national threat by the administration to the effective mounting of a war effort. And, you know, in the summer of 1917, people really do begin to realize, we aren't going to solve this problem of anti-war sentiment and potential obstruction of the war effort by the labor movement. We aren't going to solve this with state court prosecutions or with the police. in local, you know, highly sort of balkanized efforts. We need a national approach to this. And this really is the sort of coming of age party, if you will, of the Justice Department, where they mount these four large indictments, obviously the largest and first in Chicago, and they try to take down a national union that, as I said earlier, was strongly entrenched in most of the industries and across most of the country that the government needed to wage war. So that's the case I make in this book, that the modern Justice Department that we know really is born with this case. And, you know, if you fast forward to our era, we Americans, I'm not talking about lawyers, just instinctively as people living in the United States, boy, if it's a really big crime, we expect the Justice Department to get involved. Sure. Or boy, if the FBI gets involved, as the Bureau of Investigation eventually becomes sort of a semi-autonomous agency still under the umbrella of the Justice Department, but it J. Edgar Hoover manages to move it up in its bureaucratic place in the firmament. If it's a big deal, the FBI will be involved, or if it's a big deal, a really huge crime, the feds will get involved. Well, that just wasn't always so. It wasn't even remotely always so, you know? And it's this case that's, I think, the inflection point on looking to the Justice Department for large-scale legalist responses to perceived national threats, whether from radicals or, you know, of all descriptions, or, you know, some other national threat, organized crime, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. And to follow up specifically on the Espionage Act, and then I'll give you a chance to kind of plug your work and see how we can follow you. To follow up on the Espionage Act, because this was obviously a huge tool in the government's case. And, you know, again, just thinking about, our current people in the last 10, 15 years, got Chelsea Manning and Ed Snowden and Julian Assange and a few others that are being tried with the same Espionage Act. So yeah, you mentioned even First Amendment and how that really wasn't a thing back then. And then we obviously, it is a thing now, and yet this Espionage Act is still alive and well.
The Espionage Act has been amended, but you are correct that fundamentally, the Espionage Act in 2022 fundamentally is the Espionage Act as it was in 1917. And it is a dangerously broad law. The fact that, you know, it's still being used in high profile cases, I think, says a number of things. One, the government in the broad scheme tends to use this sparingly. Mm-hmm. Two, happily, from my perspective, when the government does use the Espionage Act, at least a large share of the citizenry takes note.
Sure.
You know, and talks about it. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think the Espionage Act has ever been used in a non-controversial way.
Right.
Okay? You know,
it's kind of like a Hail Mary.
It's used against foes of an American administration, where the administration will claim that it's a proxy for the interests of American people or of the U.S. people. And that may be a fallacy, right?
Maybe.
Yeah, it just may be a fallacy. Certainly would be viewed as a fallacy at any given time by some percentage of people in the United States. But governments, administrations, no matter what, you know, what party they're from or sure. what their overall leanings are, tend to see themselves as a proxy for the interests of the entire United States. And the Espionage Act gets used for things that are seen as attacks on really administration policies as much as, you know, any broader widely agreed public interest. And so it's a dangerous act. And that's not to say that the Justice Department hasn't tried to, you know, adopt some limiting principles mm-hmm. to the use of it. You know, it's a reason to read a book like mine, right. know, is to look at what's different today, because some important things are different
sure,
today.
Sure.
And what's not, because some important things are not really very different today. We've got people still sitting in Guantanamo, you know, awaiting trials in front of military commissions, although they were not members of our military, to say the
right,
least.
Right.
And so you can look for parallels where you will and when you will in American life. My point is that they're out there, that there mm-hmm. are lessons to be learned from a miscarriage of justice that happened more than 100 years ago. There are trenchant, important lessons to learn today. And, you know, the book, I hope, is an accurate, intellectually honest cautionary tale.
Yeah.
And I hope it's interesting.
It's, well. I was going to say, and it definitely, I didn't fact check it. But it's a very great read and very interesting and well done, at least from the reader's perspective. And I really enjoyed reading through it. Okay, so talk about maybe some of your other work that you want to point to, or any ways that we can follow what you're working on, if you have other book ideas or anything like that coming down the pike.
Well, the next book is going to be a while yet. It's in the early research stages. So that'll be a while. I've been writing, honestly, more law review articles, shorter form pieces in recent years, but I am working on a third book. And you can't follow me. I'm just not on any social media.
You're a wise man. There's a few that I've talked to over the years. I'm like, yeah, that's... You're in the upper echelon of intelligent, smart people that value attention.
I wish I
could be on your level.
I have enough trouble being social as it is that I don't try to do it in a mediated way. If I'm going to be social, I do it in an immediate way. You know,
very well. Sit
down with somebody across the table or talk like you and I are talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed it, and I'm sure the folks that you get to talk to on a more regular, actual personal basis enjoy it as well. So I really appreciate the time, and everybody should go out and check out this book, and it is a lot of fun and great lessons. And yeah, so thanks again, Dean, for joining me today.
No, thank you, Casey, for talking and asking a bunch of really good questions.